This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Wait, actually, let's just, because she's trying to cause problems.
Hello.
Hi, you look like Salem a little bit. Salem, come here.
This is Bear.
Salem. Oh, no, you look like Batman. That's Bear. Bear looks like my Batman.
Well, here we go. Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I'm a writer, actor, and comedian. And returning today, you know her from Aragon, you know her from The Princess Bride, author, photographer, marketer, Madeline North. Hello!
Hi, how are you?
I'm thrilled, I'm pumped. We were chatting and we said, we gotta get this on mic, we gotta get this recorded. Today's book is Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, 1847. This book stays in your bones. If you get through, I admit the first third is a little dry, but if you finish this book, you won't stop talking about it.
Yeah.
We wanted to talk about this. I read this over Christmas break. We were going to talk about it first week of January, and then I got laid off, and I was like, let's regroup next month. And then I started doing my Year of Bronte, which is a video series I started on YouTube. I'm still figuring out the tech. I got a little device last night. We'll figure that out. But looking at the Bronte sisters, their seven novels, and this is the Jane Eyre is the starting point. And what are up with those girls?
There's something going on in that house. I don't know what, but...
Exactly. It's this interesting thing of, like, there's this myth around the women, around the Bronte sisters, that Charlotte is the eldest of the four children that make it to adulthood, which is Charlotte, Emily, Anne, and their brother Branwell. And then Charlotte is also the one that lives the longest. She dies several years, you know, she dies when she's, like, 35, but she dies several years after the other three siblings, who all die really close together. Mm-hmm. So she is, like, a big part of this myth-making, because she's just the last one around. Mm-hmm. It feels like every time we try to get, like, away from this myth of, like, three girls and one brother in this misty moor, and they're isolated, and they're intense, as soon as we try to, like, take away from that, we think, oh, actually, maybe there is something in there. Like,
actually, something to that. Yeah, 100%.
And this is because I read Frankenstein in October, and she's a predecessor. Like, this comes out in 1847. Frankenstein comes out 1818. But there's something between Mary Shelley's father and Patrick Bronte, the Bronte's father, who, like, the daughter's mom dies when they're young. The father is, like, intense about their education at home. And I don't know how to search that on JSTOR, but there's something there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, especially, like, for the time for these father figures without the mother to take such an interest and to push their intelligence and their education so heavily. And I mean, I guess we see that in some way it works. They all came out of it with these beautiful, amazing works of fiction. So
yeah,
we did something right, I guess.
Yeah. And we're recording this a week before the Emerald Fennell Wuthering Heights comes out. We're both in the midst of rereading that.
Yeah.
I'm holding my breath.
I have so many feelings, and I have been instructed to go into it with an open mind, and I'm trying.
I know.
It's just the further I get into the book, and the more now Emerald is doing, like...
I know, stop talking, girl.
Now, yeah. And, like, the more she speaks and the more I read, I'm just like, I don't have a lot of faith anymore.
It is. It's like the closer we get to it, the more I learn. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did Wuthering Heights on this show with Olive Lorraine 2 years ago. It's early, so it's definitely worth a reread. But Jane Eyre is... There's so much to discuss about this book. I guess let's do a little plot summary. And of course, I need to ask your story with this. Let's start there. What's your story with this book? How did it come into your life?
So, as I think I've mentioned before, my dad was an English teacher. I was in and out of school and homeschooled, so he did most of my, like, reading education. And I'm going to be fully honest, when I was rereading Jane Eyre this time, I was like, oh, I think I had all of the Bronte sisters' books just, like, convoluted into one in my memory. Because I was like, I feel like I remember this being, and maybe we have different definitions, but I feel like I remember this being a lot more atmospheric and a lot more, like, spooky. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm rereading Wuthering Heights, I'm like, oh, this is what I was remembering. Yeah. Like, I was, like, putting the Wuthering Heights, like, vibes into Jane Eyre plot, if there is one. But, like, so rereading this was really interesting to me because I was like, I felt almost like I was reading it for the first time. And I do think that, like you said, like, you can't just read this once. There is a lot to it. There is a lot of depth, but I also feel like, yeah, I don't know. It is so interesting. All three of the sisters and their style is very similar, but then when you actually get into it and read it, they're so different. It's really fascinating. So I don't really have any specific memories with this particular book. They're all kind of convoluted into one, to answer your question.
You were so kind to watch my video, and so we'll definitely be, like, touching on that. But they feel like they're in the same sort of cinematic universe. Like, you can tell how much these women were impacted by setting of, I think they're in Yorkshire. Even though this one is much less about the setting, it still has its, like, moments to shine. Like, she's going on this long walk between sort of the Thornfield and the Rivers family segments. Mm-hmm. And there is, like, I hear this most often described as a romance meets a ghost story, which I think is very accurate for Wuthering Heights. And there's, like,
I don't think that's accurate for Jane Eyre, like, at all.
No, it's like,
I also feel like Charlotte would disavow that description, like, completely, especially as a tangent going back to what we were talking about before we were recording. She didn't really like romance books.
No, there's this, we both watched the same, we assume the same video essay that's basically like, Charlotte Bronte didn't hate Jane Eyre, or Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte didn't hate Emily, sort of myth-busting a little bit about Charlotte Bronte. My impression is that, like, first off, Jane Austen dead by the time that Charlotte Bronte ever got around. Exactly. Not actually there. They're not meeting. Fully dead. There are some letters that it's like, Charlotte Bronte just didn't like Pride and Prejudice, not because it's not good. She's just like, it's not my vibe. Like, it's not, it's a matter of, like, genre preference. So I do think there are things of, like, you know, I think that video essay also talked a lot about, like, they're sort of, like, linked simply because they're like, the only female authors around. Mm-hmm. Even though I already mentioned this, like, the connection there between Mary Shelley and this and Frankenstein is way more obvious, and I don't think I see that a ton, that comparison. But I like that you said that sort of all of the Bronte sisters kind of meld together, because I think they do, and I think that's sort of fair. The funniest thing is, there are 7 Bronte novels. I'm getting them all in Penguin Classics because that's who I am. This is the one I read before I ordered my Penguin Classics Jane Eyre. And I also ordered Agnes Grey by Anne. Mm-hmm. And those are both novels about being a governess. Mm-hmm. So even then, it's like, no, they are similar. And then I think, like, Charlotte has 4 novels. And I think, like, her first one, The Professor, is then, like, redone in, like, Shirley or Villette. And it's like the same ideas are, like, advanced or something.
Publishing timeline is weird. Like, my understanding was that was the first one she wrote, but it didn't publish until, like, after she died or something, or maybe it was after the success of Jane Eyre. There was something where it was
She and Anne and Emily all submitted manuscripts, and they at the same time they said, we'll take Wuthering Heights, we'll take, I guess it's Ten and a Wildfell Tall, which is Anne's other, Anne has 2. Emily only has the one. and Charlotte's novel, The Professor, got rejected, but the rejection letter was like, good work, like, just needs a little polishing.
I
So
feel
then,
like our girl is a little sour. I just feel like she was maybe a little sour.
the more I learn about Charlotte, it's like, I don't think I would be her friend, but I am intrigued by her like tenacity. I think that's a thing of like, well, and that what's I was gonna say, I think that's a thing of like these girls grew up in some pretty intense isolation, which is some a huge part of the myth. But I am also, as soon as I say that, again, it's like as soon as we get away from the myth, we're drawn back in, because Charlotte is also like the one who went outside. She like she went to school. She and Emily went to either France or Belgium, and Emily lasted 3 months, and Charlotte lasted 2 years. You know, she's the one who like is supposed to know more about how to interact with people, and she's very caustic, biting, sensitive, passive aggressive. I don't know.
All of the above, maybe.
But I got my copy of Agnes Grey from Penguin, and it is this same painting that's on my cover of Jane
That's
Eyre.
fascinating.
It's just like this cover of Jane Eyre is like a close-up of this painting, and if you zoom out on Agnes Grey, there's like her govern her like children that she's governess nesting. I was like, it means something. It's all connected. But Jane Eyre, you said, like, is there a plot? It's a character study, in my opinion. And we'll get into how people want to classify this and Wuthering Heights into romances, because that's just wrong. But Jane Eyre follows Jane Eyre from ages like 10 to 20 as she goes to mostly like three separate locations, which I really enjoyed, like the sort of clear delineations by setting. She's with her aunt in a really miserable childhood, and I guess I lump these together, her life with her aunt and then her boarding school that she's at, that's just, yeah, the conditions are miserable. Her friend Helen dies. Did I message you about this? There's so many Jane Eyre movies. I started watching the one with Joan Fontaine and Orson Welles because I love Orson Welles, I love classic Hollywood, and I didn't get very far because I hadn't read it and yet, and the section of suffering at the beginning was dragging on me. Helen, her friend who dies of typhus, is played by young Elizabeth Taylor.
No way.
And I
I
just
have no idea.
liked that.
I'm going to watch that one.
For it's on at least Hoopla, at least it was.
Cool.
And I'll need to dive in. But for those who don't know, Elizabeth Taylor was a child actor. But Jane Eyre, she goes to the shitty school, and then that's the first section. The second is she is this governess in this big household for Mr. Rochester, who is the love interest. They get engaged, they're at the Isle, the marriage goes wrong, which is such a great scene, and we'll get into it. Like the tentpole scenes are so good. And then she goes to live with this religious man and his two sisters, and eventually finds out that, you know, her three greatest new best friends are also her cousins, and her cousin St. John Rivers proposes to her, and then she returns to Thornfield and reunites with Mr. Rochester, and they get married. Describing every single plot point, I'm like, there's so much there we can't get into right now. Like, keep getting to the end, to the plot summary, because there's
I was gonna
so
say, you're
much.
leaving out all the juicy
I
bits.
know.
Thank
I'm really trying to get through it.
you for all day.
And so the plot is, how does Jane grow and how does she react to her circumstances? People complain that there are some faults within the plot. And what's hysterical, we were talking, we're both rereading Wuthering Heights, we're both rereading the Penguin Classics version because we're aesthetic girlies. And Charlotte writes this introduction to the 1850 version, all of her siblings die in 48 and 49. And she is like, well, Wuthering Heights has a lot of faults. We all know that. It's not a perfect novel. We all know, which is again getting into her character, her Charlotte's real personality. And it's like, Charlotte, your novel has some big problems in terms of plot. Let's talk about a couple deus ex machinas going on in here. And we forget it because it's like, it is how Jane reacts to the circumstances. But why? Maybe I posted it and you reacted to it. Why did you want to come back to this text? What was going on What plunged you in?
I think that was what happened. I think you had posted if anyone wanted to do this book, and I had already been planning my Wuthering Heights reread because of the film. And in that, I knew that I did kind of want to just like jump back into the Bronte cinematic universe. So it was, again, like I said, like more of the like amalgamation of all of them in my head, where I was just like, okay, we're diving in. We're just doing all of this. Unfortunately, poor Charlotte, like, I think she's my least favorite of the Bronte sisters, like her works.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Stick with me the least. Like, not that they don't, because I do think that they're very impactful. But in rereading it, like I said, I'm like, oh, the things that I remember being the most, sticking with me the most, are more like the atmosphere of Wuthering Heights. And
Yeah.
that seems to, like, in my memory at least, like overshadow all of the other books, really, because it is so like moving and powerful. So it's really interesting diving back in to all of the books. And I would do want to jump over to the other sisters' books as well once I'm done. But yeah.
I think Wuthering Heights just has this intensity that Jane Eyre has in moments and gets to, but those are those tentpole scenes, and Wuthering Heights, it's sort of like every page.
It's like from the bat, like from the like the I think it was like the third or fourth page, there's like a pile of dead animals in the room. Like, it's like from the get-go. And we do have like the Red Room in Jane Eyre pretty early, but even that is like you're seeing it through a child's lens, and it's a little bit more like you have this like hysterical child that's kind of throwing a fit, and you do understand that she's in these terrible, awful circumstances. She's being abused very clearly, but it's not as like ominous, I guess. When she does do her like spooky little things, she resolves them so quickly. She does take her time with a lot of things, but she does seem to like not really stick with the spookiness, or at least like the otherworldliness of things, at least the way that Emily does.
Yeah. There's the this moment with the Red Room that I, in my sort of cultural knowledge of Jane Eyre, I was like, oh, that's a really big part where she's a child, she is misbehaving according to her aunt, and she gets locked up in this room that is all red, which is just like a design choice, really. And it's where that her uncle died, like that literal deathbed, and she gets locked in there for a night. And reading it, obviously, like she's stressed, she's a 10-year-old who like does believe in ghosts more or less. But reading it, I was like, that's it? That's kind of yeah. Which I feel bad about, but and
It's
yet.
traumatizing to this little kid. Like, she's, yeah, like you said, like she's like 10. But I do think also, to me, when I think of, you said design choice, but like when I think of like homes, like from that time, I'm like, they were kind of like eccentric and like color drenched. So it's like the fact that this room was, everything was red, and the walls are red, and the ceiling was red. Like, it to me, like looking at that time period, like right now, if I walked into someone's house and like literally everything was red, I'd be like, that's kind of freaky. I feel like for that time period, it's not as significant as we maybe think it should be,
Yeah, they
or
probably
vice
had a
versa.
blue room and a green room and
Exactly. It's like the fact that it's a red room doesn't make it more ominous. Just like it's interesting to me the way that like we as a society are like, oh, it's the red room, and it's like, well, yeah, they probably have a rainbow. Like, it's just
It is the thing of like, my living room is pretty green. I don't know what to
right?
tell
Like,
you.
three out of four of these walls are drenched in green. Like, I'm like, yeah, my couch is green. This is a green room. Still not to their standards, but I think it's interesting that like, I'm not sure what the other adaptations look like. I watched the, I think it's 2011 one with Michael Fassbender, and the Red Room there. When I was reading it, I was kind of like you. I was like, that's it. And then I was watching the film, and I was like, okay, but they're gonna make it like spooky. They're gonna make it really ominous. Again, it wasn't. And it was just like looked like a very ornate room of the time. And so I think it's interesting that we tout certain parts of these books, all of these books, up, when really I think maybe that wasn't the point. I'm not sure what the point was.
That's a big question I have.
I don't think it's, I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, I think that's sort of a perfect segue into how we remember these books without remembering like the text and the actual material. I'm sort of, I won't want to say Mandela effect, but sort of cultural forgetfulness. Jane Eyre is classified as romance often, with this core relationship with Mr. Rochester, and the Thornfield section, that's his house, is sort of the middle third. And for 80, 75% of that middle third, I'm all in. I'm so excited. It's not a bodice ripper, but like it's in the video essay I said, you know, it's the best of the Pride and Prejudice hand scene. You want it so bad. You're so relieved when they get together. And then in their wedding ceremony, the priest says, "Any objections?" And someone goes, "I object." In the back, steps out of the literal shadows. And he goes, "This man is already married. He's married to my sister." And Rochester says, "Yeah, she's in my attic. She's been in my attic this whole time."
He
Jane
gets
is.
old so quickly,
Yes,
which is
he
sad.
does. Which I kind of respect. Although, at that point, if you like go back to those pages, talking about sort of the quote unquote ghost story elements, odd things are happening throughout Thornfield. The night before they get married, someone has like torn up Jane's wedding veil. And so he says like, "Well, you must be imagining things." And then Jane is like, "Well, I don't think so." And then he goes, "Well, it must be one of the staff members." Like you can see him changing truths as it's happening just to try to get her to do what he wants. And so this huge thing is revealed. He's already married. He's got his wife locked up in an attic. She is coming out and setting him on fire while he sleeps. They have it out. They have a scene where Rochester is like, "Please stay. We will go to the south of France. We will live as man and wife." And Jane is like trying to sort of figure out what she wants because she's in love with him. She's still in love with him. She says, "I'm more in love with him than ever." He is not physically violent, but he's threatening it. He is terrifying. He says, "Sleep on it." And then the next morning, she wakes up early and leaves. And that's, I think, like, that's the most interesting part of this narrative is like Jane Eyre is, I mean, she describes herself as this, other characters describe her as like meek and plain and sort of a kind of a non-entity, and yet her strength is so indomitable. And then they reunite and they're very happy and they get married, and it's terrifying. It's terrifying that they end up together. I'm worried. I'm
Like, girl,
stressed.
you don't think any of this is sketchy at all? You're not questioning any of this. People died. The castle burned down.
Jane goes back to Thornfield. Thornfield is burned down. She thinks he's died. She goes to a bartender. I love this bartender, by the way. Supporting, very, very small, awesome guy. And he says, "Yeah, Thornfield burned down. Mr. Rochester had a wife, we didn't know. She got up on the roof, set the house on fire. She jumped off the roof while he was trying to save her. And Bertha, this wife, dies." And Jane is like, "He's alive!" What? That's the only thing she takes from this story, which, like, she's 20. I don't, like, totally blame her. She has been deprived of love and affection.
She is a child, basically.
I get it. Like, she has every single person in the world telling her she is trash, and then she has a guy say, "You're great." So, of course, you're gonna go crazy. I did that. I did that in my first relationship. Not like this.
Not like this.
Not like this. Not with
Maybe
my
you can
employer.
overlook, but I think when death is involved, maybe take a breath.
Reevaluate. Ew. I have some major questions about this novel, and I think one of them, like we sort of said, is like, Charlotte, what are you trying to say with all this? And it's not necessarily that, like, I think art does not have to have a full-blown, this is what it means statement. I think art that poses questions is equally wonderful. What is Charlotte trying to say, or is she saying anything, or is she just like, "I've got a story and I want y'all to hear it"? What's going on?
Yeah, it's interesting because like you said, like if it poses a question, then that's one thing. But I'm like, what question is she asking in that case? Because I don't know what she's saying. Because she
No.
is self-professed, well, close enough to self-professed as not having written a romance book. It was not a romance. They still get together in the end. Her character has no questioning. Like, she's not second guessing anything at the end that makes you like, oh, maybe she's like growing as a person, and like maybe there's something that happens after this, you know, like where she's like starting to figure out Mr. Rochester's tells or something like that. So what is the question then that she's asking? Is she asking maybe, I don't know,
Yeah.
the validity of love, or
Yeah,
I don't know what she's saying. I don't know
yeah.
what she's asking. I don't really know. Like, it's a brilliant story. I love it, but I don't know what the point is. Like, in
Yeah,
the
I
end, you know, like, because there's so many things that we just gloss over, and it seems like these are the things that the story should be about. So it's like, did I think maybe you mentioned this in your YouTube video, like, did she miss this? Or
Yeah.
are we missing, like, as a society? Like, are
Yeah.
we all, is she just smarter than all of us? Or are all of us, like, seeing something that she didn't? Like, I don't
Yeah.
know.
Yeah. One of my biggest questions is, does Charlotte think this is a happy ending? This is something I said in the video. Is my reading of this as a horrifying thing what she wanted?
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I think something that people really pull from this text as sort of a revolutionary thing, and I'm not going to deny that, the big quote that people, you know, embroider on pillows from this is Rochester is telling her he loves her. There's sort of a misunderstanding. Jane thinks that he is engaged to someone and so is sort of like pulling her chain. And she says, like, do you think just because I'm a woman that I have different feelings from you? Like, we are equals despite gender. And so that's the big thing that everyone takes from it. Fair. I think the sort of cultural thing that this novel has done that gets overshadowed by the romance is create like a really incredible female character in terms of representation. I am interested with your book knowledge if you know this. I only saw it talked about a little bit, but the fact that this is in first person is a little revolutionary and a little, I mean, not revolutionary, but a bit different and new
Yeah, well,
within writing.
wasn't okay, I could be totally mistaken, but I was pretty sure that this was originally written as, or like published as, a like pseudo biography. And
It was
so
certainly like thought of it
originally,
that
like,
way. Yeah.
people, like the first readers, like they thought it was a biography for like a long time. And that was something that was quite new at the time. I'm not sure about specifically like the first person, but I do remember like people thought that this was like a nonfiction like biography.
Yeah. The sort of publication story of this is so weird because they publish under male pseudonyms, but they choose kind of like gender neutral names, or they're like, we didn't choose really masculine names. It's Kerr, actor, and Ellis. And this is, there's I don't know if I mentioned it on mic, there's an incredible book called The Bronte Myth by Lucasta Miller that I am reading that talks all about this. And it's sort of like, well, we changed our names because people think less of female authors. And they kind of wanted to stay out of the spotlight. Emily really, really did. Charlotte stepped into it later in her life and like became sort of part of the writerly world of England. Jane Eyre was an immediate success. And then people started to be like, I think this was written by a woman. And then the reviews started to tank as soon as people started to think it was a woman. And then everyone is like, who do you think wrote Jane Eyre? It's like a topic of conversation.
My understanding, I didn't know that like people started to figure out that it was written by a woman, because once her sister just died,
Yeah.
she came out and said, "We wrote these books." I wasn't aware of that, but I do know that a lot of people thought that they were all one person.
Yes.
So I do know that. I remember reading somewhere that when Charlotte did come out and like reveal their identities, at least with Emily, people didn't believe that it was written by a woman.
Yeah, it's
because of how
too.
visceral and like violent and aggressive it is.
Exactly.
So that's interesting that people like started to pick apart Jane Eyre and
Yeah.
figure that out. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
And I need to, go back to this book, but I think people were like, she's talking about the drapes a little bit too much. She's talking about the dresses a little too much. A man wouldn't do this. And then at the same time, like when it is first published, people are like, the insight into this character, only a man could do, right? It's like the genius is only capable of,
Insight into a woman's mind. Only a man could do that.
you know, who can best talk about women? Not a woman. Some of my other big questions, right, about this text are around Bertha. Bertha is the wife. Oh, there's so much we haven't said. I think Bertha only appears on like 3 pages of this book physically, and yet is sort of like one of the most important characters. Bertha, woof. Rochester has, when his family is still alive, Rochester's family has financial interests in Jamaica. When he's in Jamaica, his father and Bertha's brother arrange a marriage between Rochester and Bertha. They get married. He finds out that Bertha's mom is insane. Bertha starts to show signs of insanity. He locks her up in the attic. My question, was Bertha actually crazy, or was she just not what Rochester wanted? Was she just a little coarse, just a little different? And of course, there's a huge question about Bertha's race. She's from Jamaica.
Well, I think it's an interesting discussion because at that time, like, he could have had her sent away. He did not have to keep her in the attic. Like, there were institutions at this time, literally for men to send their quote unquote crazy wives just to get rid of them. Like, he could have done that. He could have had her declared insane by a doctor and then been free to marry anyone else. Like, did not have to go through all of this trouble, did not have to keep her in his attic.
No, who? And I think like maybe part of the reasoning there is like, well, I can't get remarried. And he's very much like to the brother when the brother shows up at the wedding, he's like, it was unfair of you to saddle me with this forever. And I deserve to be happy. I deserve to have a nice wife. I'm trying to find it in the little Charlotte writes a little introduction to a later version. There is some guy who is like a fellow writer. I can't remember his name. When Jane Eyre comes out, he's like, "This is a good book." And Jane thanks him. And then I think it comes out that like, oh, he has a crazy wife. And then people are like, "Was Charlotte writing about him?"
Oh my God.
These are very like these books have a very I love that there is like not a book talk world, but there is always like a gossip sort of culture, you know? Humans have always been as they are, you know?
There's so much drama.
Yes,
There is so
and
much drama in
Charlotte
this
loves to stir
family,
it.
and
Yeah.
she does. She's standing over the cauldron with like a giant broom. Like, I don't know what she's doing. She is just
Yeah.
stirring up so much tea.
And you know she's cackling.
She is.
You know she's cackling,
She lives for it. And it's interesting that I think earlier you said none of the sisters wanted to be in the public eye. Charlotte did.
Yeah.
Charlotte absolutely did.
Once those other two were dead, she
She
jumped
was
in.
like, they're gone. I am going to reveal their identities. I am going to slander them basically in the prefaces of their own books.
They're bad writers.
I just, she
There
was
is this
so
thing talking about Emily where she's like, I don't know where Emily got all this power. It must be like a divine source or something, because there's no way Emily could have written
saying,
this.
I know exactly the quote you're talking about. She was saying that, like, the spirit of creation
Yes.
like flowed through her because Emily never could have done that. It's like, you're talking about your sister. That's what I'm saying. Like, this
You were
girl
talking
is
about your
sour.
dead sister.
Dead sister, your dead younger sister. This girl is so sour. She is so prickly, and she has no real reason to be, but because, like you said, she should be have been considered like the most successful, right? She
Without a
did
doubt.
go out, she went out into society, she was successful in society, she had the most books published. Yeah, her first book got denied while her sisters didn't. But like,
How much comes back to that?
and I wonder their, you know, home life with their father was so heavily focused on their education, right? And I just can't help but wonder how competitive that household was made, because if that's like all you have, you're secluded from society, like all you have is your father and all he cares about is your education, you're just gonna start to like butt heads and resent, you know, the only other competition and the only other people that you're like in, yeah, secluded with.
And my understanding is like their father, Patrick, I don't think was very affectionate, probably.
Probably not.
And the Miller book talks about this, is like I think they sort of, the siblings kind of were like, Charlotte and Branwell were a twosome, and Emily and Anne were a twosome. And Charlotte and Branwell were a little bit older, and they're reading all these magazines. They're like really, really entrenched in the literature of the day, and yet they're all guys. Charlotte does not really have any kind of model for her to possibly envision herself within this world. And then she writes a letter to one of her favorite authors, I think, just asking like, how do you do that? Like asking some kind of writing question. And he says like, you should have babies. Like you really shouldn't pursue a career in this. So
Wild.
in addition to the professor, her first novel being rejected, like how much of these little slights build up?
I can understand, like, from a older sibling standpoint,
Yes.
like when you work so hard and struggle so much to like pave a path, and then your younger siblings just come along and they just walk it, right? And that, like, I could see how that would be frustrating for Charlotte, right? However, it just feels vindictive sometimes, you know? And like you said, like they're dead at this point. Just feels so almost cruel to just diminish them in that way, where I could see, like, if we were reading like letters that they had exchanged, where she was like maybe saying that to their face through the letters, like while they were alive, like even that I think would be more understandable from like a frustration like siblings standpoint, her being like, I did all of this hard work and you guys are just getting published, like sure. But yeah, for her to like wait for them to die and then do all of this and like sort of like push them down, it's fascinating. I don't know. It's icky.
Well, thinking with that, I thought of two things, and both are occurring to me just at the this is the first I'm hearing of them within my own head. Elizabeth, or excuse me, Charlotte leaves. Like Charlotte goes to a couple different schools and comes back at one point and teaches Emily and Anne the things that she learned. So to me, there's partly like, does she feel like these girls learned it from me? Like I am their educator. I wonder that. And then Emily, Anne, and Branwell all died really like within a year of each other, I think. I think Anne dies like 5 months after Emily, and I'm not sure about Branwell. So I'm also like, that's traumatic. Gosh, that's gotta be awful. So like, is there some kind of like reaction in that?
That's a really weird
It's a
reaction.
really weird reaction. It's a
That's a
really weird
really weird
reaction.
reaction. I'm sorry. Like
It's a really weird reaction, especially because like she lost two sisters at the same time, you know, 20 years earlier. I want to say
I
grief
don't
does
know.
weird things to people, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, not to judge the way that she's deals with stuff,
Damn, girl.
but that's a strange way to deal with it. I don't know.
You know, my question about Bertha being actually crazy, that at the end, Bertha allegedly jumps off the roof of Thornfield, and Rochester is like right there next to her, apparently trying to get her down. Does Bertha jump? Is she pushed? Suicide or murder? That is my question.
The way I read it is that she was pushed,
That's
that
how I
he was
read
just like, this is my out.
it. It's right there for him.
Why would he not do that? Like, this woman in his mind has taken everything, taken his happiness, taken his money, infiltrated his home, taken away Jane. Why would he, like, I understand like him not going out like and straight up just like murdering her, right? Because we assume or we're told that he's a good human, right?
He tells us that,
He tells us
certainly.
that, and the servant woman, the
Grace?
housekeeper,
Yeah. Oh, Mrs. Fairfax. Yes, yes, yes.
tells us that. But I just don't see any person, I don't see any man, clarify, being in that situation
Yes.
and not being like, well, or at the very least, I think that he didn't actually try and stop her. You know, like
Yeah.
at best case scenario, I think like he got up there and was like, you know what? I do like he might have gone up there
Yeah.
to save her and then been like, you know what? Actually, I'm
Yeah.
just gonna let you do you. And like, we'll see what happens. But I do think I read it as he pushed her. He was like, he at that point, he has nothing to lose. He's severely injured. We don't know if he's like gone blind and like he lost his hand. Or like his hand was disfigured,
Yeah.
and he goes blind because of it. We don't know like how injured he is in that moment, or if it happened when he was trying to get back out. He's lost everything at that point. Why would he continue to
Yeah.
like try and save her? Like, why wouldn't he just be like, you know what? Bye. One last thing.
Yeah. My movie mind is taking over and can envision this scene in so many ways. And I would like I much prefer in writing in general things to be choices rather than accidents because I just think it's more interesting. But I can also imagine a director or a writer having Rochester up there on the roof and having Bertha like reach out or like trip and stumble and he just stays. And that the inaction is a choice in itself. But I also read it as she got pushed. Yeah.
Best case scenario, the choice was him not to act. Best case scenario, worst case scenario, he pushed her.
I think
He
so.
totally pushed her, and no one's questioning it.
Freaky. We talk about things that don't age well. I think this is the thing that doesn't age well. Because the rest are like questions, right? There's so many questions around Rochester. There's so many questions, especially around Bertha. She's from Jamaica. We don't know if she's a person of color. And I think that's a question that will never be answered. I've started reading some articles about this. Didn't get very far just because, time happens. But Bertha was from a wealthy family. She was like a plantation owner. So that makes me think she's white. Ultimately, we're not going to get an answer there. But the thing that like really does not age well is Rochester's injuries. Rochester loses his hand and goes blind. And to me, at least, it really read like disability through divine intervention and like now that he has been maimed, he has like done his penance and now he's allowed to like reunite with Jane is really I don't think I'm putting a 21st century lens on that. I think that's pretty in the text.
I feel like disability as punishment is pretty awful. Like for her to, whether or not she's saying, again, I go back to like, I don't know what she's saying,
I mean, I know that her eyesight was awful,
but
like she was sick as a kid, but I doubt that she associates, like,
I
even
don't.
today, like,
She wouldn't put that together.
exactly, even today, people forget that, like, wearing glasses counts as a disability.
Yeah, I struggled with that part, but I also struggled with like, to me, it felt like even though Jane had spent the entire book basically declaring that she was his equal, right? She wasn't actually his equal until he was disabled. Like until he was knocked down multiple notches, like he couldn't stand on his own, he couldn't see. He's basically had to have everything done for him, and only then were they true equals. And then at the end, for him to actually be able to start moving on his own, and for his eyes to start to come back, was just this weird twisted. Like I'm like, what are you saying? What does that mean? What are you saying with that? Because
Ultimately, he and Jane get married, and there's a little like when his son is born, he can start to see a little bit, and he can start to, and like as they live together.
do children solve everything? Are you like appeasing the gods by having children? And so the divine like curse is being lifted? Like what is that?
And I think a lot of people also read a lot of Christian themes into this, and that's just like a thing that I can't speak on super well, and I don't feel like is actually, I don't know, maybe it's just because she doesn't actually say God a ton, although the Thornfield section, the middle third, is sort of the richest and draws the most conversation. Yeah. The final third, she is with her cousins, who she finds out halfway through are her cousins. Her boy cousin proposes to her, and it's an incredible scene. I think a lot of Jane's character, it's sort of the culmination of all of these aspects that we've seen developing through Jane. It's a really incredible character study. He wants to marry her. She has the understanding that he will always love God, and I think his like aspirational quality, which is sort of, to me, I think like that's the word that she uses more or less, and to me that's also like he will always love himself and like the way other people see him. Way more than he'll ever love her. But he wants to go on a missionary trip. He doesn't want her to come in any other context than as his wife. He sort of demands it. There is even a moment of like, and of course we'll have sex. Of course we'll have kids. Duh.
Yeah.
That really freaks me out. And so she starts to slowly feel herself softening. And this happens a little bit with Rochester, where she's like, the longer I have to live with it, the harder it will be to deny it. So she's about to crack, and she goes, dear God, tell me what to do. And God sends the disembodied voice of Mr. Rochester calling her name. And she says, I must go to him. And she does.
Yeah.
Literal divine intervention.
That does happen.
It is the epitome of Deus Ex Machina. And I mentioned this in the video, when Charlotte gets out in the world, she meets Elizabeth Gaskell, who's a novelist who writes, her most famous work, I think, is North and South. And ultimately, when Charlotte dies a few years later, Gaskell writes the first biography of Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And there's some myth-making in that, and I think it's also like, maybe you shouldn't write the biography of your friend, it's not going to be really objective, but it also seems like she put in a lot of research. She, like, you know, really tried to be sort of, now it's my cat's feeder going off. She really tries to create sort of the best biography possible. And at one point, they're chatting before Charlotte dies, and Elizabeth is like, great novel, what about this? Come on, divine intervention? What are we doing? Uh-huh. And Charlotte says, no, that really happened to me. That really happened to me. Which I need to know more about. I think that's in, like, maybe the introduction here, but do you remember how you read that when you were younger, or just how did you hear? Charlotte Bronte believed in the possibility of extrasensory perception, at least for finely tuned individuals. But it is a true thing. It really happened, she protested when her friend and biographer took exception to the incident. Love it.
My thing about this book,
yeah,
that I think I mentioned, and I compare it a lot to Wuthering Heights because, yeah, like I said, they're like convoluted in my head. And now with these rereads, I'm like, oh, these are very different texts. I feel like Jane Eyre, and I think I mentioned this earlier, like she does these little like supernatural, like ghostly things, but she doesn't like stick to it. So like, I'm assuming that when I read it the first time, I had a very similar reaction to when I read it this time, where I was just like, really? Like, what do you, but like, what do you do? Like
if it was an established pattern, I would definitely read it differently.
Exactly. But like with like the Red Room, and I don't know, she doesn't really have, I mean, I guess Bertha is the other weird, like ghostly thing that is very like easily explained, right? It's just like, you could have just like stuck with it and made it a lot more impactful and powerful, but like, in the context of like the way that it was done, it just feels like this throwaway solution.
Absolutely. It feels like she hadn't fixed it otherwise. And the way we were talking, like, much prefer choice to accident or coincidence. It would be such a more interesting, I mean, for such a rich character already, it would be so much more interesting if Jane, who, you know, clawed, that's the thing, like, she's in these two situations where Rochester and St. John both want to marry her. She knows she cannot say yes to either. She drags herself out of Thornfield the first time. She survives. She doesn't make the choice. And then, and I think this is I know I was thinking about it when you were talking about Rochester, they are not equals, because he has so much. He is her employer. He is rich. He is a man. He has the resources that she does not. And when St. John proposes, everything is different. She has this inheritance. She has family. She has friends. She has all of these resources, and yet that is the one that she needs God to help her out of.
Yeah.
I think it would just be like a more satisfying character arc if she was able to make that choice.
I feel like Jane Eyre is like touted as this very feminist figure, mm-hmm. which she is. She was for her time, and a very strong-willed character who can make her own decisions. And I feel like there are times where she does that. When she leaves Rochester in the early like hours of the morning, that is very impactful. When she leaves the boarding school and doesn't like accept her fate within the cycle, that is very empowering. But then there are other times like this where she just kind of lets things happen to her. Mm-hmm. That I just feel like is so contradictory. Like, if you're going to write this empowered feminist female character, again, it's like with the ghost stuff, it's like either do it or don't.
Yeah.
So she's a very frustrating character to me in that sense, where she is very combative. She is very like intelligent and holds her own. And then the next scene over, she's just like, letting things wash over her and just kind of like going with the flow. And that was frustrating to me, I think.
Because there are plenty of novels where like a character tries to do something and fails, and that conveys something about the story, but I it doesn't feel purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I so love doing the research and learning about the authors, because I think it brings so much more context to this and room for discussion. And I do wonder, like with Jane Eyre, with so much of her writing, like it is to prove that she can do it. I think a lot of, like you were talking about with competition and siblings, I think Branwell was her other half, and he's a boy. Like, he gets to be, there are so many hurdles that he does not have to go over. Oh, there is, if it's supposed to be a nonfiction work, it's very bad at that, and I think it's more of a novel, but Daphne du Maurier, who writes Rebecca, writes a book about Branwell.
No way.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
I think it's, like, extremely difficult to get a copy, but okay. I'm gonna.
What will happen?
You know, if, like, anyone was going to write like an eighth Bronte novel, Du Maurier can do that cinematic universe.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, Manderley, which is the house in Rebecca, is Thornfield. It's all of them. You know, absolutely. I'm looking at my notes. There's just so much that like, you really got to read the book, folks. It's so good. Like, that's the thing. Like, we have all these problems with it, and also it's really good. It's
yes.
It's a really, and it's such a fun read. Just get through the first third. I promise. I was talking to a friend about this recently, a couple weeks ago, and she was like, God, that's the most boring book. I hated reading it in school. And I was like, I get it. You know, you really got to put the work into to get into it.
We're talking about the Penguin Classics, and I have this one here, Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
And I have Wuthering Heights. They're about physically the same size.
Mm-hmm.
This book is fully Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
And about a quarter of that book for Wuthering Heights is just all of the introduction. So, like, in size-wise comparison, she's a chunky girl.
Yeah. That's one thing you can certainly say about Emily, is she's concise.
She is. Yeah. So, I mean, definitely maybe could have used a little edit in that.
Certainly. There were some sections where I was like, Charlotte, I really don't care what this room looks like. Sorry, babe.
Yeah.
There were a handful of pages I skimmed. Skimmed, not skipped. God forbid. But yeah, it's like we haven't gotten into the last third, which I think the last third is like, you gotta read it, man. You gotta read it for yourself.
Yeah.
But there's this sequence where St. John is revealing to her that he has found out that they are siblings. And it's a little bit frustrating because all of this happens off page, but it's also like Bronte writes it in a way that is so fun because he is talking. He's like, oh, you seem a little surprised that I knew that. Well, I did. And keeps going. Like, there's just some parts.
Funky, yeah.
He's an interesting character, and He and Rochester are very, very interesting parallels because, and she brings it up a lot. Like, it's not a, she's not saying like, where Rochester was kind of ugly. You know, St. John is gorgeous, but she does talk about how gorgeous St. John is. Like, she does talk about his, he again, like, it's only in the last third. I think in the Michael Fassbender, Mia Wachowski, he's played by Spider-Man, Tom Holland, I think.
No. That was that Tom Holland?
I
It
think like a
wasn't.
very young, still looking like Billy Elliot. Fact
What?
check me on that. Fact check me.
Wait,
It's been
hold
a
on.
long
I
time since
watched
I've
that
seen
whole
that
damn movie
movie.
if I did not know it was Tom Holland. That was not Tom Holland. Hold
It's been a long time since I've seen it. And I do feel, I think people say like that's the best kind of adaptation. And I
No,
again,
oh my God, that was not Tom Holland.
no, who was,
He
oh, is it Jamie
looked like him.
Bell?
Look, Jamie Bell.
Jamie Bell. I think they look similar.
They do. Okay, in
Confirmed,
this
not
scene, like
Spider-Man.
in his name, he looks just like Tom Holland.
That
You're
looks like
right.
Tom Holland.
You're right. That's wild.
Not Spider-Man.
I was like, Tom Holland would have been so, way too young for that.
That's true. That's what you're
Yeah,
very right.
no
Nevertheless, I think you did a good job, what I recall.
Holland is my age. He did not film that in 2011.
Oopsie, when he was 12 years old. But that's very fun. That last third is really, really satisfying. This character arc, while it has its flaws, is really something to behold. She really places every brick very carefully. How many other Bronte novels have you read?
Of the sisters, I think I've only read one of each of them.
Oh,
I think I've
okay.
only read Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, and I think, what was the, I haven't read Agnes Grey.
Tenant of Wildfell
Yeah,
Hall.
that one.
Yeah. I think that might be my next one. But again, Jane Eyre feels like a book you can spend a whole college course on, you can talk for ages about. But it's Saturday morning and I want you to have a nice Saturday. So, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we have not covered? I think I'm good.
I don't think so. We touched a little bit, like I struggle with the marketing, I guess. I
Oh,
don't know,
yeah.
the cultural like understanding of both this and Wuthering Heights. We did touch on this like I think a little bit in the
But I
beginning.
also want to touch on, you're in marketing, so I think this is very fascinating.
Yeah. It's in my head a lot right now, especially because of Wuthering Heights and the film coming out and the discourse around it, and how Wuthering Heights specifically, like the tagline or like the subheader in all of the movie trailers, or at least the first couple, is the greatest love story of all time.
And I hope there's like an asterisk. I hope we're all like winking at
I mean,
that.
my problem, okay, so my problem is I don't think we are. And I
Yeah, I
don't
think you're
think
right.
enough people have read these books. Like, it's not, our education system is not good enough to support the wink wink of it all, right? There are, specifically in classics, there are Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre, and then the other one that really bugs me is Love in the Time of Cholera. So those are three classics that I feel like are touted as romances a lot, and like love stories. And they're all like, you pick them up, and less so with Jane Eyre, though we both, I think, agree that this is very toxic and like really abusive at the end. But at least like the other two, like you pick them up and they are just the most like vile, like manipulative, aggressive, violent relationships. And they are beautiful stories. They are beautifully well written, like fantastic, amazing stories. I understand why they are classics. But why in the hell are you telling me that this is a romance? Because one, what precedent does that set for young women specifically? And two, like what a disservice. Like I'm very picky about like if I am told that something is going to be one thing and it turns out to be another thing, like I really struggle with enjoying that. So like Love in the Time of Cholera, I didn't read that until a couple of years ago, and I was told that it was a romance, 100%. And so the entire time that I was reading it, I was so pissed off. I was so mad. I was just hate reading this book. You know, I finished it and I was like, yes, this is a beautiful, fantastic, amazing book. Why the fuck was I told that this is romance? This is literally an adult man stalking a 12-year-old until she gives in and marries him. When you tout these books and these stories as something that is so vehemently not true and so inaccurate, it just does such a disservice to not only the original text, but to the people that are now going in with this fresh lens of expecting one thing, and you don't give them the grace to make their own interpretation of it. You're very deliberately telling them, in the case of Wuthering Heights, the greatest love story of all time.
Yeah.
Which it's not. You can say, yes, it is a love story. Mm-hmm. It's not a romance. So like, okay. But I think even if you're trying to be like, hey, wink, wink, we all know this, right? Mm-hmm. We know that this is not true. Again, I literally just do not think that at least the American school system has given people enough of the tools to be able to understand that.
Yeah.
Be able to not internalize that very deliberate dedication of the greatest love story of all time. Mm-hmm. And then going in and watching this film, hopefully she stays true enough to the text that we know that it will be very toxic and abusive and awful. And I just feel like people don't necessarily have the tools to recognize when they're told deliberately that this is one thing, this is the greatest love story, to be able to recognize it for what it actually is.
Yeah. In the, I think the first poster and the first trailer, the title was in quotes, in quotation marks. And I put so much hope in those two little quotation marks.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And that's how I think they've stuck with that. Mm-hmm. They've stuck with quotations, from what I can tell, it is on everything. And again, like you said, it's like, if it is this character of Margot Robbie making an interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. Or if it is, I don't know. There's a lot.
Yeah.
I don't really know what else to say without just being blatantly like.
Yeah. Well, and then she's compared it a lot to Gone with the Wind. I mean, the poster even is, which I really appreciated. I was so enthusiastic about that. And they don't end up together, like, very famously.
I love Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like, again, it's very different audiences from what this is, like, touting to be. I mean, even to mention, like, the blatant, like, sexuality, just that from what we've gotten from the trailer, right? Whereas this book, while it's very, has a lot of tension, it's not a bodice ripper. It's not, like,
they never have sex. And that's a huge thing. I don't even think
they might kiss. They maybe kiss.
I'm not sure. But yeah,
but it feels very disingenuous. Mm. And like we had talked before we started recording, the Guillermo del Toro recently came out with an adaptation of Frankenstein, and he has presented it as a very similar, like, experience as Emerald has supposedly presented Wuthering Heights, where he said that this is, Frankenstein is his favorite book of all time, and he's wanted to make this adaptation since he was, like, a child. And so he's been, like, building this adaptation in his head since he was a child. And when you hear him speak about it, you can just feel this reverence for the original text. And you can tell that he understands, whether you like the adaptation or not, you can tell that he understands that he cannot do it necessarily perfectly, but that he is going to try his darndest to be honorable towards Frankenstein and Mary Shelley. Whereas when Emerald speaks about this text, it feels like she doesn't care, and it feels like she can't be bothered to care. And I just feel like, as a whole, like, as a society, we kind of seem to approach stories like this in that way, where if we're told Jane Eyre is a romance, one, if you're reading it with any intentionality, you're just going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's not a romance. And two, if you're not, if you're just sort of skimming it and reading through it, you're gonna miss the signs of what I would hope that Charlotte is trying to say.
Yeah.
Again, we're not entirely sure what she's trying to say, yeah. But the undertones of how, I don't want to keep using the word toxic, but how toxic.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Relationship is. And how, like, I guess, like, the dangers of that. And maybe what Charlotte is trying to say is, like, to not let yourself be a Bertha, which is really sad. That's awful.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure what else she was trying to say. But I think if you go into it and you just let people tell you what things are, then you're never going to allow yourself or allow the text that exploration. So I get very frustrated.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like one last thing on Wuthering Heights is like, how many people are going to watch the movie, love it, go to read the book, and then hate the book because it's not the movie? That's something I'm concerned
too.
About.
That too. Because like, I've seen a couple of people who have seen the movie. Obviously, they can't have any spoilers or whatever, but I've seen a couple of people say, if you read the book, you're going to hate the movie. Right. If you haven't read the book, you are going to absolutely love the movie. And I feel like that's the same for Emerald's last film, Saltburn. I had not read Brideshead Revisited. I had read Talented Mr. Ripley, but it wasn't like presented as as an adaptation. So I caught those connotations, but it wasn't upsetting to me. It was more like this is a nice thing to catch and to see. But I feel like people are not going to be able to do that with Wuthering Heights because of the way that it's being touted. I don't care if you put quotation marks around it, you're still saying that it's Wuthering Heights.
Yeah,
you're still putting the movie poster on the book.
Yeah,
which is a huge thing too. I was like, if people's early theories of maybe it's someone reading Wuthering Heights, etc., that's all well and good until they put the movie poster on the book, and then you have people again picking up the book with this wildly misconstrued idea of what this story is. And I feel like a lot of young readers, a lot of people who maybe don't pick up books very often, haven't read any classics, you're right, they're going to pick it up and they're going to be really disappointed.
Yeah.
Which sucks. Because it's a great book.
It's a great book. And I'm intending to talk a lot about this with the video essay, but there's a second half of that book. There's a whole second generation in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I learn about Charlotte, because I am very, and I think we talked about this a little bit, it's like, I want to give Charlotte, in my mind, I want to say that everything she did was intentional, that she like went into this, I want to assume competency, right?
Right.
And intentionality. Right. And the more I learn about her, I'm like, I don't know, because both sisters have this really toxic relationship within their texts. And in Wuthering Heights, I mean, they kind of end up together, but they're both dead. They're both miserable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Jane Eyre, they end up together. And while we as readers, we being like at least the two of us, have this cognitive dissonance of like, I wanted them to get together, and I was also very afraid of it.
Yes.
You know, I was glad that they reunited, and also the whole time it's this cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Charlotte had that in mind, and that stresses me out. I do feel like the success of Jane Eyre is her determination, her stalwartness, her sort of loyalty to herself. Yeah. She says to St. John, like, I'm never going to get married unless it's someone I passionately love.
Yeah.
And there is, like, I haven't read it, but there is a letter where Charlotte turns down a suitor. And it's very, there's some real correlation with that and her rejection of St. John's proposal. But I don't know how much of it is intentional. I don't know what she's trying to say. And yet I love the book.
Like, yeah. Yeah. Charlotte is interesting. I think, I don't remember if this was before we started recording or not, but we were talking about how a lot of people say that Charlotte hated her sisters and hated Jane Austen. And we had both watched that video that was saying, guys, she doesn't hate these women, she's just giving valid critiques. And while some, at least in Jane Austen's, because that when I was watching the video, that was what I was focused on. Why are you hating on my girl? while some of them are valid critiques, when you kind of get into it, she's very passive aggressive. She does say something along the lines of she is like a garden without I don't remember exactly how she phrased it, but she said she compared Jane Austen's writing to like basically saying that there was no substance to it, right? And so we want to give Charlotte the benefit of the doubt, and we want to assume that she meant no ill will towards her sisters. She meant no ill will. She was just critiquing another author. Totally valid. And she totally knew exactly what she was doing with the ending and with Mr. Rochester. However, the more you dig into it and the more you see what she did write about her sisters and the way that she spoke about them after their death and what she actually did say about Jane Austen, etc., the more you're like, how much grace can we give this person? You know, which is, again, it doesn't take away from the text. It doesn't take away from our interpretations of it, and the discussion around it, which I think is one of the best things. If a book can make you sit here and talk for 2 hours and not be done, I mean, I could talk about this book all day long, whether or not we are discussing the things that Charlotte wanted us to discuss is something that we won't know. But she is, as herself, as a person, a fascinating character.
Very. And she didn't read comedy. I think she didn't, and she didn't even like at that point get out in the world a lot. You know, I think like the satire is of a, and maybe I'm getting the timeline wrong, but a satire of a world that she was not really a part of super well. But I think it's also like I wanna treat the author as intentional as sort of like, you know, assume they are 100% and then pull back as you read. And I think that is what's happening with me here. And it's also like this mythologizing, and you know, we're you can't separate the text from the person, because sometimes the person gives even more insight and value into it. And I think the more interesting reading is like is to see the whole person behind it. But yeah, it is like, I don't know what you wanted me to get from this.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. Because like she leaves it open-ended, but also not real, like not really. Like it's not, I don't know. It's just that I was fine with it. I wasn't fine with it. I wasn't happy with it. But I was like accepting of it until he started to heal.
Which is the last couple pages, yeah.
Literally, like the last like 2 pages. Because like, okay, I don't agree with the, like you said, divine intervention of like his repentance for his crimes is his disability. That is like a whole other discussion to have, right? But if that's what she's trying to say, cool, fine. Again, I don't think it's very feminist of her to be like, we are now equals now that you're disabled. But sure, okay, that is like sort of like a clear cut, like, this is what she's trying to say, end scene. This is it. And I was like, okay, I don't like that, but like, sure. Like
Can't
that makes
undo
sense.
it.
That makes sense as to like, this is a statement that she is trying to make. But then when you add that ending of him regaining his sight and being able to like move around on his own and everything like that, now it just erases the entire quote unquote statement that she was making previously. And now I'm just confused. I don't know what you're trying, like, what are you trying to say? Because, and it's not presented in an ominous enough way where we as readers understand that he probably killed his ex-wife and he had her locked in an attic. It's not presented in a way where, like, to me, I'm like, oh, is he got a kid, he got what he wanted, he got an heir. Is he now going to lock Jane in the attic?
100%,
But it's
100%.
presented like in a way from the author that it seems like that was what she was trying to say, where it's like it's a cycle and men are always going to be abusive. It's not like she's trying to say that. It doesn't seem,
No.
you know,
And
intentionally.
is it not because he has changed? It's because Jane is what he wants. Jane is, you know, timid and meek. And even then it's like, well, they chose each other. You know, this was an arranged marriage to Bertha. It is a successful text because it can create this amount of conversation, I think. Yeah. Should we try to wrap it there? Try to coming on 2 hours?
Hours. I mean,
Oh,
I don't think that you can ever be done
No, absolutely
talking
not.
about this book because there are just so many questions that she doesn't answer. And then you do the cycle that we've been doing for 2 hours where it's like, did she mean to even pose this question? Are we talking about completely different things here? So it's just a cycle that I think is never ending, but it's fascinating. And whether or not that means that it's a good book, like I think it's a good book, but you could also argue that like she was too unintentional and like that's poorly written. Like there are different ways to like
Which again is all the
look
things she says about Emily, which is
at
a, I think, a book that like just functions better.
Wuthering Heights is very like, again, they don't end up together. So if that's Charlotte's like criteria for like a good ending, like closing the story, then one, I think that's very hypocritical of her to be going after Jane
100%.
Austen if that's her like criteria. I'd be curious to see what her other works look like. Now, having learned so much about Charlotte as a person and doing these rereads, because like I said, I've only read one from each sister, but it's just, yeah, Wuthering Heights just is a clear cut. It has a story, it is telling multiple stories within stories. And yes, there are questions and there are things to discuss. And I could talk about Wuthering Heights all day long as well, but in a different way that feels more intentional. I think
Absolutely.
like when with Wuthering Heights I would like talk about I guess it's similar, like we're still talking about the author's intentions, but we're not questioning the intentions, I guess we're not questioning the validity of them maybe. So yeah, it's fascinating. I'm so excited for the rest of your video essays.
Oh, thank you. Well, I guess that brings us to the big question, which is not for me going to be an easy question. Would you consider it required reading?
I don't know. When I was first rereading it this time, I said no. I like in my head, because obviously that's what the podcast is for. So like I'm reading it with this lens of, do I think other people should read this? I think if you are just reading this and like sitting in your own head, I think maybe not. Like if you're just like in your own little bubble, and you have no intention of really like diving deep and exploring, whether that's through video essays or conversation or book club or reading biographies, etc. I don't think it's worth it as a text. But I think if you want to do the work of jumping into the Bronte cinematic universe, as it were, then absolutely, I think that this sheds a lot of light or opens a lot of doors, more like opens a lot of windows to these sisters in this world. And I do think it's a fantastic book to have a conversation around. So yes and no.
Yeah, I mean, I think my answer is no, which I never, I think had we recorded this, we're recording on February 7th. I think we had initially set this for January 5th. I think my answer might have been different then. I think I might have said yes.
That's so funny because my answer would have been no.
Really?
Because my answer, like right then, I was like, absolutely not. And then we pushed it back. And I've spent this month basically watching video essays, start reading all of the preludes to Wuthering Heights that Charlotte wrote, right? And watching the adaptation. And now I'm like, there's meat here that I didn't initially get. Or at least feel satisfied by just with the text. So like when I read it, even when I finished, it was so funny because I think you had texted me like the day before and you were like, I'm so excited. There's so much to talk about. And I was like, oh, this is gonna be interesting. I'm not happy right now.
I
And
think,
I've spent this, yeah, this month like just like, okay, well, I have time now. Let me like just dig into it. And now I'm like, okay, if you have the time to do this, then yes. But if you don't have the time or like the desire to branch out and like do additional readings, do additional research, then I don't think it's worth it at all.
I think my answer is no, go read Wuthering Heights.
That.
And I feel bad about that because it's saying, you know, these three sisters are essentially one entity, and I feel bad about that. And yet I also feel like that's how we look at it. That is it.
And I think that they're so entwined
They
just in
are.
who they are, you know, like the
They will always be in
circumstances,
conversation. Yeah.
you cannot separate them. And like I said, when I was reading it, rereading it this time, because my brain was like had all three books
Yeah.
convoluted, I found myself wishing the entire time that I was reading Robert. The entire time, every time she started to mention something a little bit spooky, and then she like let me down with that,
Yeah.
I was like, you know who wouldn't do this? My girl Emily, she would not do this. So I fully agree. Like, if you just want to read the book, if you just want to read a classic, read a Bronte sister book, Wuthering Heights is the only one that I will ever recommend in
Yeah.
that, which, yeah, it is unfortunate. And poor Anne,
I know.
it's just like,
We'll get
let
to her one day.
me know. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
fascinating. But I agree, I don't think that you can separate the sisters at all.
And I think this is a perhaps a video essay thought, but in a lot of those introductions, Charlotte calls Emily's work immature and her work mature. And I think maybe that's like, maybe you're defining mature as adhering to expectations.
Again, that's why I question like what her other books like really look like, and if they end with a stereotypical happy ending, like is that her criteria?
Yeah.
Because is that's her criteria for maturity, then she is no better than the people in the society that she claims to be critiquing.
Yeah.
Really disappointing.
Yeah.
And it devalues everything that she's written.
Yeah. 'Cause she even says in the there's a later introduction into Jane Eyre, and she even says, conventionality is not morality.
Then why are you acting like it, girl?
Yeah. And I'm also thinking Charlotte, we know, fell in love. We don't know that Emily ever did. Emily probably didn't.
I don't think so. I don't even know that she ever had any like actual suitors. She was the most secluded
Exactly.
out of all of them.
And she seemed happy, secluded. Like she seemed.
That was seemed like how she wanted to live her life.
Exactly. Yeah.
It seemed to me in everything that I learned that Charlotte is the one that was like never quite satisfied, like never quite happy with her standing, never quite happy with her home, with her place in society. And I feel like that's probably where a lot of that sort of resentment comes from, is one, we had talked about like her sister's maybe interpretation of like an easy path to success that Charlotte had paved, but also just their contentness in their life.
Yeah.
And they were happy and they didn't, I think Anne went to school, right? With her.
I'm
She
not
didn't stay with them
sure.
long,
Yeah.
but they were happy
Yeah.
with the life that they had and creating the art that they did. And it Charlotte, she just never felt seemed like she felt quite satisfied.
Yeah. I mean, looking at her biography and looking at when this was published, Charlotte, and I haven't done a ton of research into this, Charlotte goes to Belgium to study under a professor. Emily goes for like 3 months and then leaves. Charlotte's there for about 2 years. She seems to fall in love with her professor, who's a married man, and that doesn't work out. And so, to me, the question here, and I'm pretty sure this was more or less shortly written after they get back, how much is this wish fulfillment? This man who is literally already married?
No, 100%.
Yeah,
I mean,
especially because it's so autobiographical in the other parts.
exactly. I think she just wrote fan fiction of her own life.
Yeah. The answer is, you know what's required? Wuthering Heights. Sorry, girl. But that also feels like the ultimate cosmic revenge of being, of like putting Charlotte in her place. Sorry, girl. And Anne, we'll learn about you one day. I'm so
We
sorry,
will get to
girl.
you, Anne.
Well,
I'm sure it'll be worth it,
yeah,
honestly.
I will say I'm much more excited for Tenet of Wildfell Hall than I am Agnes Grey. But we'll get there. We'll see. We'll see.
Well, I feel like Agnes Grey and Jane are just like a little bit
Yeah, too close.
too close. It's like
But
too
maybe
hard to
Agnes
get with.
Grey is better. We'll just have to find out and read the thing
We will
ourselves.
find out. Yeah, you're gonna read all of them, aren't you?
Yeah. Buy myself the flowers to quote another literary girly. That's all I've got. 2 hours later, that's all I've got. Where would you like to be found?
I am on Instagram and TikTok and possibly YouTube at That Bookish Witch.
Woohoo! Thank you so much for
Of course,
coming.
this is always so much fun.
Oh, yay! You're always welcome back.
Thank you.
Oh, and I'm finally figured out how to finish the podcast, and that is by reading the last line of the book.
Oh, I love
So, oh, I actually, oh, this is another thing I wanted to discuss. The final line is St. John's.
Yes.
I'll read the final paragraph because it's only a couple sentences. My master, he says, has forewarned me. Master is God, has forewarned me. Daily he announces more distinctly, surely I am come quickly, and hourly I more eagerly respond, Amen, even so come, Lord Jesus. I don't like that last line.
Oh my God, I could talk for another like
I know.
multiple hours. I feel like I should not start.
I know.
I feel like
We
I should.
shall leave it on that. Thank you for listening. The end.